Welcome to What's Left, a weekly political discussion challenging the mainstream left. I'm Eduardo Barca with Andy Lipson. And on today's show, we will be discussing, well, we will be updating the GM strike. And we will also be touching on the Chicago union strike, where 35,000 teachers have gone on strike. This is now their ninth day. And just global manifestaciones around the globe, and most against austerity measures and inequality.
And I had asked Eduardo that I thought this episode would really be focusing on the Chicago teacher strike, but the more that I thought about it, the more I realized that we had to talk about the GM mm-hmm. strike in light of it, And then the more I looked at the GM strike, it made me think about what's actually taking place in Oakland, which I want to talk a little bit about, because mm-hmm. Oakland teachers had a strike last year that I thought ultimately was a loss and a setback, although it was a victory that they went on strike, and I think that's something we're going to be talking about today. And then it forced me to think about these explosions that are taking place across the globe in Chile and Ecuador.
Mostly in Latin America.
But in Lebanon and Iraq?
Yes.
So I mean, yeah. I think at this point we can say it's many places, and it makes me think about what we talked about yesterday or last episode with Kenny about where will the socialist revolution, would it need to happen in the United States? So we'll get there, you know, because mm-hmm. I feel like what that's happening right now totally convinces me even more that these things will be connected, but revolutions, if they happen, can happen anywhere, and they will impact everywhere.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's...
But yeah, let's get started.
On Chicago. Let's just get there a little bit, just to give some context. Like I was saying earlier, the current strike in Chicago is now in its ninth day of negotiations and encompasses both the CTU, which is the Chicago Teachers Union, and Service Employees International Union 73, which represents the classroom aides, custodians, and other workers who keep the city school system serving some 361,000 students running.
Yeah, it's about SEIU there. That's about 7,000 of their 29,000 members that are paraprofessionals and janitors and mm-hmm. things like that. Yeah,
those two units together represent about 35,000 workers. That's why that figure was there. There are 35,000 teachers, 35,000 workers,
mm-hmm.
and tens of thousands of whom have been picketing this week outside of their schools and flooding Chicago's downtown center.
Yeah.
Well, I'll give my take in a second. The CTU, which is, again, the Chicago Teachers Union, is arguing for higher pay to keep up with Chicago's mounting cost of living, alongside a long list of other requests, including smaller class sizes, more school nurses, librarians, funding for bilingual education, and access to affordable housing for teachers and their students, an estimated 16,450 of whom are homeless.
And the issue of special education has been highlighted in terms of getting more support, which would be the paraprofessionals, getting more of those people, having them get paid more as well. I think it features large, actually, in the contract.
And this is nothing new to any union protest across the USA. Most teachers want smaller class sizes. Most teachers want more support for their students. Not just teachers, employees, anyone who's there, and personnel want the support. So a non-bipartisan issue.
Yeah,
it affects wherever you stand on whichever party line.
Right.
That's why we talk about the red wave last.
Although I think that the emphasis on this strike that I've heard, at least talked from the union, even though wages feature in it, and the mayor or the initial offer by the mayor and by the Chicago Public School was ridiculous in terms of wage increase. It was a very small wage increase, with the statement of we're going to give you a very small wage increase, but we're going to increase the cost of healthcare and benefits, which again usually that comes into taking a pay cut. Mm-hmm. So that was miserable. But I actually believe that CTU's biggest issues, the major emphasis they're making, is on work condition issues, and I understand that. Like, I actually think things are it's getting harder and harder to be a classroom teacher, and it's burning people out in the same way that, you know, I can imagine GM auto workers are feeling the same way, you know. But so I think that was interesting to me, is that the emphasis is a little bit more on the work condition stuff, which is actually what I predict will happen in our own negotiations.
Here in San Francisco.
In San Francisco, yeah. Uh-huh. And I think there's truth to that. I mean, the amount that it costs to live in a city, at this point, your wages can't keep up with these costs. So not that I think teachers can, well, we should give up on wages, but we actually have to insist on work condition issues alongside those wages, because that's one of the hardest things of maintaining that job has been the burnout.
If you can't even live there, you can't afford.
Well, it's not just living there. It is actually working in those places under conditions that are increasingly getting more and more responsibilities are being borne on everyone, whether it be librarians or counselors or nurses or the classroom teacher who doesn't have enough paraprofessionals, and the paraprofessionals who are underpaid, who don't even have full-time jobs often. All of us are working under hard, like really difficult work conditions that are just burning people out real quick. Mm-hmm. So the jobs are becoming unsustainable. And we've already heard about how more and more people are leaving the education field and things like that. So this fight around work conditions is a vital one.
And we should point out, this is the third largest school district,
I think so,
in the USA.
Yeah.
I think I was reading that. And
New York's the biggest, LA is second biggest, I think Chicago is third.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. 300,000 students, I think, are served in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Now, I was listening to KPFA just, I think it was 2 days ago, or I'm not sure when, but the newly elected mayor, which is Lori Lightfoot, elected this year. Well, let's just say that she is the first African American woman and first openly LGBTQ mayor of Chicago. I only mention this because, as we said with Alabama, when the anti-abortion bill passed, mm-hmm. or they were considering it, I think it was in the legislative body, but then the governor was approving for it.
Yeah.
This was a woman, you know, in favor of this legislation. And here we have what we think, or what most liberals would think, would have a woman and a first openly queer woman of color that would be in support of these protests, you would think, right? Has called for teachers to go back to work as the negotiations are ongoing. Essentially, we'll deal with this and you just need to go back to work and don't worry about it, we'll handle it, but you don't deserve the right to go out and be on the streets because you need to be working. That's what we're asking for you.
The district has no more. They're saying, we have no more money for you. We're out. You know, our pockets are empty. That's what she's claiming.
And one would think that if you're electing someone that is under this identity politics idealism, that you would have someone that would be on your side, so to speak, because they are all these different intersectional layers about themselves that would be more understanding and sympathetic to one's cause. But again, I think this is another reason why we just cannot base it on electing a certain person because of the color of their skin, or electing a certain person because of who they are as who they identify, because it's not going to work. Someone is going to be a capitalist, someone's going to be pro-privatization, whatever color, gender, whatever identity they may hold. And I think that's why I wanted to bring that up. That was just that tidbit, because she is considered one of the most progressive mayors, but yet she is calling for the strike to end.
Right, and she's basically telling that she's going to do everything in her power to break the strike, to defeat the strike. The strike's demands, which are smaller class sizes, resources for public education in Chicago, which teaches the most underserved. And not only does this show that identity politics is not up to the challenge, I think this exposes identity politics as literally a tool of the ruling class for attacking the working class. Hmm. I mean, to me, what better representative for the capitalist than an LGBTQ African-American woman to say, you teachers, you're hurting black kids. You're hurting black kids who right now have sports that they need to be going on. They could be going to these important state finals and things like that. You're hurting black kids. You're the one keeping kids from having their meals right now from coming to school. So the capitalist class gets to have a black woman say that. It would be very hard for a white person, white male person, straight, whatever, you know, it would be easier to penetrate that and say, you're a liar, you're a capitalist liar. But now, because of identity politics, people think that she's different because she's saying that. Well, who benefits from her being able to say that and seem credible? The working class? No. The ruling class. The ruling class has a black woman, and this is not just happening in Chicago. There have been a whole bevy of mayors around the country. In fact, I saw an article recently that black Democrat mayors, female black Democrat mayors, are more prolific than at any time in recent history. And not only who are better to come out and break strikes, but who is it better to gentrify a city? You know, there was a whole time when it was about taking money out of the city and things like that because it was white flight. Well, now that is reversed, right? The trend is reversed. Money's coming back into the city. And who better to say the money's coming back into the city, but it's not going to go to the people of the city. It's not going to go to the African-American citizens of that city. Who better to do that than a black politician? Mm-hmm. And that's exactly how identity politics is being used. It's literally a capitalist cover for racist attacks, working class and racist attacks on our children and on our people. So literally, identity politics is a liberal weapon of the capitalist class, not only used to divide workers in our country within our class, but to actually, you know, ideologically attack us and say, oh, you know, I'm the one because I have this identity. I can tell you, I can be credible in saying that, you know, I care about black children. If she cared about black children, she would do exactly what she says she can't do, which is take the $1.5 billion that's supposed to go to development of these Lincoln Yards and say, no, we're going to push it back to the schools. She's saying that's not even up for discussion. Why does she care? Whose side is she on if she's a person who's supporting people who are poor? And she literally ran for mayor on the CTU platform. She adopted almost everything they had. So now this has been exposed. Like, and it just, to me, shows that it's not about identity politics falling short. We have to understand identity politics are a tool of the ruling class used to smash working class and used to gaslight us on a level, you know, everywhere to make it seem like, oh, they must not really be attacking us because either a black person is telling us or a woman's telling us. No, like, you know, I recently saw a thing on how there's all these women heads of Raytheon and these various military industrial complex companies, you know. So it's like, you, whether you're black, woman, gay, when you're a capitalist, you're going to come after the working class and you're going to benefit only your class. And we have to understand that.
I think many, I will consider myself, I'll say for myself, many of us have fallen for the identity politics pyramid scheme when were in 2008 voting for Barack Obama.
Yeah.
Because we not I well at that time I had different ideals, but most people voted for him because of they identified with him because he was going to be the first black African American president. But we have to remember that even after he was elected, there was 8 years of so-called hope, and what has been really the preparation of that soil for the, I don't want to use a garden, the preparation for whatever we were sowing at that time is reaping right now for Donald Trump.
Yeah.
So I think when we look at Donald Trump, we have to look at really the roots of these things, the causes of this, because it's not under Trump that these things are happening. They are exploding from having had a fertile 8 years of capitalism that Obama had. So why am I saying this? Because I think now that we are looking at these presidential elections in 2020, and we have more women, more Latino, we have a Latino, and we have people who are speaking Spanish, liberals are going to fall for this trap. Like,
liberals are laying this trap. They're not just falling for. I mean, liberals are laying this trap for us. Mm-hmm. I mean, I understand.
And
what
you gullible
mean.
Liberal, people are
liberal,
going to vote,
or liberal
for
voters
who are
people,
going to vote for it based on what they identify
right,
with.
Correct.
Right. They feel that because someone is speaking Spanish, like Beto O'Rourke, or because Julian Castro is is Latino or because Warren is a woman,
right,
that you should vote for them because they will be sympathetic to you as a person of the same race or the same gender or the same, you know, whatever identity you might identify as, or even if you don't have the same identity, because they're part of this oppressed group that intersects, they will have somehow some understanding of who you are as a person. But that could be something that where, if you still don't have the that you don't have identified, if you have not identified that they're not just a woman or they're not just a person of color, but you have to identify that they are a capitalist and they are a Democrat and they are a Republican. Those things are the essential things for you to really look out for.
I think I want to come back to this Democrat thing, because one of the mistakes that I think Chicago Teachers Union is making, and I'm not really going to spend a lot of time criticizing the Chicago Teachers Union, even though I do think there's probably some criticisms to go there. But the one mistake I will, the one thing I think is really wrong, and it's like, so at the same time, Lori Lightfoot, a progressive Democrat in power as a mayor, is attacking the Chicago Teachers Union. They invite Elizabeth Warren to come and speak to the people and say, oh, Elizabeth Warren's going to save it. In fact, Randy Weingarten, basically, who's the president of the AFT, she's not CTU, but the statement is likely endorsed by the Chicago Teachers Union in some way, shape, or form when they let her, when they let Elizabeth Warren speak there, and then when they let Randy Weingarten speak there, to support Elizabeth Warren, is basically saying, if we had, Randy Weingarten said, if we had Elizabeth Warren in the White House right now, we wouldn't even have to be here out in the streets, because she would settle this.
Who said this?
Randy Weingarten. Mm-hmm. I think Randy Weingartner, I think it is. Mm-hmm. The president of AFT, American Federation of Teachers. Mm-hmm. And that's a lie. I mean, she's basically, and Elizabeth Warren went there to basically say, I'm with you. I'm trying to put a tax on the rich that would raise $800 billion, and some of that would go to education and da-da-da-da. First of all, Elizabeth Warren knows that she's not going to do that. She knows that that's one of the election promises she's going to make in the primary that's going to fade away after she becomes the real presidential candidate. And then if she does become president, that's going away for sure. It's gone. You know, she's putting this out there as progressive red meat for people to think, to have some kind of hope that the Democrats are going to offer something. It's a lie meant to gaslight you into voting for her, okay? But the real thing is how can you have the Democratic Party attacking the union one time and another member of the Democratic Party coming in to save it? Why wouldn't Chicago Teachers Union say, you're not coming here to talk, get your party to discipline Mayor Lightfoot and tell her what to do. Make her do what we say she should do, or else you're not speaking here. We're not going to let you do it. Forget you, Democratic Party. But the reason they don't do that is ultimately, and this is probably true for Chicago Teachers Union as much as anybody, no one ultimately wants to be too critical of Lori Lightfoot, let alone Elizabeth Warren, because everyone's afraid of Trump. And so Trump gets everyone to, this fear of Trump gets everyone to put aside their criticisms of all sides. And that's death. There's no future for us, for the labor movement in that. Again, not independent, you know, if we operate that way, and it kills the union politically. I was critical of the first 2012 strike, and I'm not going to get too much, unless you ask. I don't know if it's
I would
too
like
much.
To know, because at that time, I don't think I was paying attention to Chicago.
Yeah.
I remember it in 2012, but I think I was focused on other things.
Yeah, I mean, I think the one thing I would say, and I do ultimately think that I would give Chicago, the big break, first of all, I think it's important that Chicago teachers went on strike. It was important that they went on strike for more than one day in 2012, and it's important that they're going on strike right now on a protracted strike.
Yeah.
But
they're on their ninth day.
They're on their, eighth or ninth day.
Today's
and
ninth.
Yeah. And, but if they settle this weekend, then I'm going to say it's the same old, same old. Because this is how these strikes have been. 5 days, 6 days, 7 days, and then settle. And actually, President Jesse Sharkey, who used to be in the ISO and now is a DSA member, and I want to give him the credit of saying at least they took the people out. I'll give him that credit. And is already making words like, wait, we want to go back into the classroom, you know. And so I think, unfortunately, I'm looking already to see that there's going to be a settlement reached this weekend. And I think that will to me, indicate a loss. And not the advance for teachers will be if we can go 2 weeks, 3 weeks, 4 weeks for the strike and try to grow the strike, you know. which is what needs to happen. It didn't, and it didn't happen in the case of GM, and it needs to happen in the case of Chicago. They need to escalate, not de-escalate, which is what I think they're trying to do. Now, will they be successful escalating? That's not a secondary question. That is but you still have to try. And otherwise, the capitalists and the bosses are going to get you. That's what happened to GM workers, which we can talk about. And I think it's what will happen in Chicago, and they'll be forced to settle for, like, one of the offers that they had was, we'll have decreased class sizes only in low-income schools. That sort of, you know, and 15% of your students will have lower class sizes. And, you know, you'll get a librarian, but not something more for paraprofessionals. Or not necessarily, nothing better for nurses. Essentially getting a partial compromise. And they should not accept that. They need to expand the strike and get more from them and force Lightfoot to basically beg them to exit the strike and give them more money. You know, that's what you want to do, is you want, in the same way they're trying to break your will, you have to break their will. And the only way they can do that is by expanding that strike.
Can you, we touched on this once with one of our guests. What is our response when the Lori Lightfoot comes out saying, basically, there isn't any money?
It's a lie. There is money. There's just not money. They're not allocating money for schools. There's one wealthy person in Chicago who has $49 billion, this guy Fitzger or something like that. The fact that they're already putting $1.5 billion to a new development that's a plan that they have for Chicago gives lie to that. They've just chosen not to allocate these funds to education. And they're choosing not to tax companies in there because, for the same reason they don't do it in San Francisco. They're trying to create a business-friendly environment that will bring wealth back into the city. It's the plan. It's the gentrification plan. How do you get investment to come into the city? You get wealthy people to come into the city. How do you get wealthy people to come into the city? You promise them lower taxes. You promise them they can do business here on the cheap compared to some other city. That's how they do it. And so, essentially, it means you get money in the city by being the most appealing to the wealthiest of the world and the wealthiest of your state, and draw them there, or the wealthiest of the country, and draw them there, and then you flush out anybody who doesn't have money because it becomes too expensive. Mm-hmm. So Lori Lightfoot is doing the work of gentrifying the city. I mean, she didn't start it, but she's continuing it. But she's just going to do it with a different skin tone than Rahm Emanuel. But it's going to seem more believable. She can seem more credible when she says, I'm doing this to revitalize the city and for all our people and for black people and for white people, whatever. And it's a lie. You know, it's an attack on workers, and it's going to hit the people of color the most because, as we said, capitalism oppresses us all, but oppresses some more than others. And this is what's going to come down on the heads of blacks and immigrants more than it does on other workers, even though it's going to come down on all of us.
I remember that Chicago was an example, a prime example in 2012. I don't remember all of the details right now. I forgot some. But I think most of the districts here in the Bay Area were looking up to Chicago.
Yeah, and it was right, just like GM strike, which has now ended. the Chicago teachers and their union deserve to be applauded both in 2012 and now for going on a strike. The problem in 2012 is the district said, I mean, the Chicago school district said, we're not going to allow you to bargain over school closures. It's mm-hmm. kind of similar to Oakland. Mm-hmm. And Chicago teachers didn't insist on it. They talked about building all these solidarity groups, how we're in solidarity with our community, we're going to save our schools and things like that. And they didn't do it. Like, they said, well, we can't do that. It's non-contractual. You can't go for that. You have to extend the strike. You have to extend your demands. And ensure that you don't close the schools, because what happened, as soon as the strike was over, 49 schools were closed, thousands of teachers lost their jobs, mm-hmm. and it seemed like a defeat. And this is what they're going to do. The bosses, if you don't make them squeal, if you don't make them suffer and feel the pain of your strike, they're going to bring it back to you after at the end. You have to make them afraid of you, and they didn't. They basically tried to cut a deal with them. They got a few scraps, but that's when, right after the strike was settled, and there was about a 20% no vote on that strike that people didn't want to talk about. But 20% of the teachers knew they were about to get screwed once this thing was over, and that's what happened. And the other thing is this is what happened in L.A. is you cut loose the people you said, oh, this is a broader fight. This is a fight for social justice. You can't compromise on these things then. If it's social justice, you got to go for it all. You can't say, well, we can't get what you want. We're just getting what we want. And that's why I do think it's now harder to build those links now, because it was proven a lie. It was proven that we only fight for ourselves. And I think LA is going to face the same thing. Nevertheless, I commend these teachers for going on strike. I commend that union. We haven't done it in San Francisco. We have to do the same thing and learn the bitter lessons of these defeats even. And I think there's something going on in Oakland that shows me the value of the strike, even if it goes on to defeat, because there's fistfights taking place on the Board of Ed meetings, you know, versus the police. And that stuff wouldn't be happening in Oakland right now if they hadn't gone through the bitter strike they did, if they didn't have the large no vote, you know. They learned the lesson of struggle that you have to, you know, you can't play nice. You have to go for it all, and you have to ask for it all, and you can't say, well, I'm this is as far as I'll go, you know. And I think that frustration and even that desperation is showing itself in Oakland, but it's been earned. It's earned frustration out of the fact that they themselves did fight for the school closures and against school closures, and the school district said, well, we'll at least suspend it. But as soon as that suspension date in August was done, school closure started. And the union had no answer for it. And so now there's frustration, and now they're going to the Board of Ed to try to stop it. And now you see video of police on one line and protesters on the other, and people are crossing it, and then there's scrap. I mean, that you would never see that in San Francisco. In fact, I don't think you will see it in San Francisco unless we go on strike and we really put something on the line and experience what it means to lose, really. We have to lose before we're going to win. And I don't mean lose. Like, Oakland got something back, but ultimately it was a defeat. And that's what's happening for the GM workers. That's what happened to the LA teachers. That's what's happening to the Oakland teachers. And that's what Chicago is going to experience. They're going to call it a win. They're going to say, oh, if they reach an agreement Saturday and Sunday, I guarantee you Jesse Sharkey is going to tell us how wonderful agreement that is. But I guarantee you it's a defeat. Because the union isn't stepping up the cause, isn't stepping up the struggle. It can only mean defeat.
I invite our listeners and viewers to go check out our episode with three teachers that were on strike.
Yeah.
And the fourth retired teacher that was giving us a lot of context, that is really heavily involved and knows the contract like the back of his hand.
Yes. Yeah. That was Jack.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And Donna from Oakland and Claire from LA.
Yeah. And another teacher as well. Italian background, I forget his name.
Oh, yeah. Jimmy.
Jimmy, yeah. Well, GM, should we? Some 40 days after United Automobile workers walked off the job, picketing General Motors, which is GM, that's what we're referring to for people who may not be familiar with these acronyms, plants. Picketing General Motors plants and grinding operations to a halt. The labor's union members have ratified the tentative
deal. Yeah, 57 to 43%. Which is a fairly significant, that's a pretty significant no vote. That was the level of the no vote in Oakland.
Mm-hmm. That was today, the 25th of October, Friday.
Among accusations, and I think probably true, all the things I've read about the strike come from World Social's website. I have to give them credit for their coverage of this. Mm. It's been hard to find good analysis of what's going on. And I think they do a lot to criticize the crooked and corrupt labor leadership. Obviously, they're criticized GM as well. And I think it's true, and I actually think that the way the vote was done was to basically make the plant that was going to be shut down, the Lordstown plant, be one of the last places where the vote. So the vote was taken in individual sites, and one of the last plants to be done was a large plant in Lordstown, which was going to be shut down. And there's some offer of reconverting that to an electrical plant that builds electric cars, but there's no guarantee about it. It's nothing guaranteed, so it's mythical. But it's some statement that the GM said, "Oh, we're planning on doing that."
What I did read is that GM will close three factories.
Yeah, Lordstown was one of them.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. So the union organized this vote in a way to create the greatest likelihood that they get a yes vote, which is what all unions do. It's not just UAW. All unions do some version of this. But, you know, I have no question that there's funny business with regards to it. Do I think that the vote is, like, that the vote was actually a no vote, I don't know. But I don't believe that I believe that the union did everything they could to create the conditions for a yes vote. And clearly, even though they did that, they barely got it, 57-43, which is not great, which says that many workers walked away from this deal after 6 weeks of on strike, very unhappy. And they should be. One of the things I know that they got is GM is saying that they're going to will make the lower tier temporary workers permanent workers if they work 3 years without any layoff period. Mm-hmm. And people were like, what are you talking about? All they have to do is, you know, lay us off for almost a weekend and then we're done. We have to get rehired and stuff like that. You know, so
it's setting them up.
So it's like, there's nothing, you know, we should be grandfathered in. We've already been working as temporary workers. We should come in after the strike as permanent workers, you know, and it should be 90 days. That's the thing. And they're not getting anything close to that. The second thing I know that is not good is the top tier is going away. And essentially there will no longer be a tier in which people get pensions, and retiree health care. And that to me is pretty crazy. That's preliminary stuff that I heard. So it looks like a really bad deal. And not much was gained from everything I heard from initial things that were asked for and agreed to by GM.
Well, the UAW says it will turn its attention to the Ford Motor Company contract next.
Which is crazy. Why would UAW wait till 40,000 of your workers get, you know, knocked down and then put them on the line and say, oh, here, why don't you try this now? Like, what you wanted to do was, once those 40,000 GM workers come out, bring the Ford workers out, collect all those, get all those contracts going. Mm-hmm. Instead, you piecemeal, piece by piece. Once these sets of troops have been defeated, let's put our other troops out there. And it's like, well, no, that's going to be low morale. They're not going to want to strike very long. This is the UAW setting up their own workers to not want to strike. You know, or if you're going to strike, do it very tentatively, because you've basically withheld some of your forces at a battle when you needed to bring all your forces into the fight. So it's nuts. And I don't think they're stupid. I think that they don't want the strike. At the same time, they have to give themselves some sort of credibility, because many of these UAW people are going to jail, you know, because they were, like, you know, accepting bribes during previous contracts, or taking union money and doing all sorts of crazy stuff with it, buying hookers, whatever.
From the strike fund. Yeah.
Yeah, so it's like they would lack credibility. I will still say this is a significant thing that a set of private sector workers of this size has gone on this long a protracted strike. And I do think this is going to be...
40 days.
Yes, and I think it's going to be demoralizing. Like, there's debates I'd seen on the left about, or labor notes, about will workers be encouraged by this? Will they be demoralized? This is going to be demoralizing, no question about it. But it's going to be a bitter lesson that I think is going to produce anger and will produce some kind of response, because this is, I believe, the U.S. working class is actually, this is the most strikes we've had, most workers on strike we've had in almost 3 decades, I think now happening. And it's not very much, actually, but it's growing. And when you look at what's happening around the globe, in Chile, in Ecuador, in Lebanon, which we're going to get to, you can see the United States working class is starting to learn some lessons. Because the level of struggle in Chile is off the hook compared to what's happening here. That's the level we need here.
They're using the military against their people.
Yeah, and
we'll get there.
Yes, and the level of militancy in those countries is far advanced of where we are at. But we only have the chance of getting there if we go through this season of struggle. And it's not going to be pretty. It's not going to be fun. It's not going to be like, oh, win, win, win. In fact, it's going to be lose, lose, lose. But you get thrown to the mat and you get, you know, beaten up, and you get back up and you say, okay, what do I have to do to not get beaten up this time? And that's when what's happening in Oakland, to me, indicates the lesson that workers are learning. It says, you know what, that never would have happened, you know, pushing police and things like that prior to the strike. You would have never seen anything like that happen at a Board of Ed. Well, it's starting to happen in this country now, where you have physical fighting happening between teachers and police. That's meaningful, you know, and that's our hope, is that more struggle will produce more lessons, and will produce more militancy, even as it also produces more bitterness, you know. And the left has to act on that, not on people like Bernie Sanders and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez lecturing, you know, what's his face, lecturing Facebook on how to shut down the internet more, you know. So,
well, before we
sorry, that was like a tangent.
Well, let's wrap up here on the strikes.
Okay, so we're kind of
yeah, because we had the Chicago strikes and the GM strikes. You wanted to say a few last words. You said something about what could have been done alternatively.
Yeah, I mean, so clearly the for the GM strike, the not taking the Ford and the Fiat workers out on strike was a mistake by UAW. But I think at the end of the day, where I really put the onus of the defeat, of these defeats. And I think it's also true for Chicago teachers. Like, what could be a game changer for them? The only way we could really change the game for U.S. auto workers or for U.S. teachers in any given city is for that strike to spread. To strike spread throughout the city and spread to places like San Francisco so that we as workers feel automatically like, wait, our fellow workers are on strike in Lordstown or in Detroit. We need to go on strike. And the reality is
sympathy strikes, right?
And the reality is that one thing that was that characterized these strikes was that mainstream media virtually not covering them to make us not hear about it. But even had we heard about it, unfortunately, we as a class are not. That is not how we think right now. It's not even just how our unions operate. We as a class do not yet have that instinct that says we can't let those people suffer. We have to go out together and make this happen. And that, I do believe, is the difference between, in part, it's the difference between the United States and places like Chile and things like that. Part of it is the attack is general, where, you know, there's an across-the-board increase that is then creating an across-the-board response. So that's partly to do. But we can't let our own workers get picked off this way. And it's very much connected, again, to the question of immigration. If you're willing to cut workers loose across a border and say you can't come in, then you're going to cut workers loose in Detroit. You're going to cut workers loose in Oakland. That's just the way it is. Don't think that just because there's no free lunch here for the working class. We are either internationalists who fight across the board for each other, or we're not. Or we're nationalists who basically say you workers are good and these other workers are not. And if you fall for that, then we will never have true solidarity. That's politically something we have to do. But obviously, organizationally, the working class has immense amount of work to do to allow to make it so that when one's attacked, the rest of us go into the struggle as well. And it's no different. I mean, this is how workers struggle, this is how workers get over in their own workplace. When they know that their fellow workers aren't going to fight with them or fight for them alongside them, then they cut deals with their bosses, mm-hmm. you know, to see if they can get the best thing. That's what happens at our workplace. It's what happens in any workplace. And that's the situation our class faces right now, that we essentially leave those workers who are actually willing to put out a fight. When we don't fight along with them, then we essentially abandon them to cut deals with their bosses, the best deal they can get. And it's that's going to have to end if we're really going to see changes in the kind of agreements or the kinds of things that are going to happen.
And I think that just as people come out when they see a Latino person is being targeted, and Latinos come out in waves, I think we should come out in waves as a working class.
Yeah.
Then we really would be united, and we would have more demands met, because
right.
there are more of us then.
And of course, ultimately, it needs to get to the point where it's not about demands for a contract. It's not about that it will ultimately have to be, we are ending capitalism. We are taking the means of production out of your hands, and we are reclaiming them for ourselves because you can't be trusted. Mm-hmm. So that is also a piece of that. But the only way we were going to see the kinds of game-changing agreements is if there are strikes that set off other strikes. That's illegal, but we're going to have to break the law. So the laws are not made to make it easier for workers to fight. You know, the laws are made to make it harder. So we will have to break those laws if we're going to actually make the kind of gains we want to, that we want to see.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right. Let's try to shift our focus, which is still related, connected to the larger picture here around the world. So if we just zoom out some and we see what is happening across the globe, we will find that in places that in Iraq, Lebanon, in Chile, Algeria,
Catalonia,
Lebanon, Catalonia, Catalonia,
mm-hmm. Ecuador recently too.
Ecuador and Bolivia. Mm-hmm. There are massive protests that are happening globally. There are these manifestations, these protests. The data shows that the amount of protests is increasing and is as high as the Roaring '60s and has been since about 2009. This is coming from Jacqueline Van Stekelenburg, a professor who studies social change and conflict at Vrije University in Amsterdam. And I'm just going to say this small little figure here about Oxfam. Said in January that the world's 26 richest individuals owned as much wealth as the poorest half of the global population. Billionaires grew their combined fortunes by $2.5 billion a day in 2018. Or BN. BN is billion, no?
Yeah, billion. Okay.
A day in 2018, while the relative wealth of the world's poorest 3.8 billion people declined by 500 million a day. Mm-hmm. So I thought maybe I'd just share that as we delve into these protests, because this is what's happening. It's these
That's
disparities.
The context,
it's
yeah.
the gap of inequality. It's the austerity measures. It is the stifled democracy. And this is all in all of them that we have mentioned, capitalist countries. Mm-hmm. They all consider, I mean, I'm not talking, I know that even the so-called socialist countries are going through something, but the ones that we are focusing on are not, they don't even describe themselves as socialist countries. That's mm-hmm. why I'm pointing that out. So I don't know what you want to say about them.
I agree that the context is social and economic inequality globally. I think they'll say that, oh, well, Chile, it's because of the history of Pinochet and fascism. Well, that fascism was brought from the Chicago Boys, Milton Friedman, who basically underwrote the economic plan for Chile that Pinochet put in place. So this is the United States working with the fascists to create the economic conditions that now the Chileans are being blamed for, when the United States was the one who actually plotted the whole thing about how they were going to like reorganize the Chilean economy and use it as a model for reorganizing the South American economy, mm-hmm. Or other countries in South America. So the U.S. has a heavy hand in that economic inequality. But it's important to understand that the economic inequality is not just in, you know, what people often refer to as like third world countries. There was something I read. It's called the Gini index. The Gini coefficient says that, and this is the most commonly used statistical measure of income inequality, places the United States at 41.5. Barely less unequal than Chile at 47.7. Mm. So economic inequality in the United States is on par with these countries. The level of organization, I think the presence of the Democratic Party, the weakness of the left, I actually think those are global issues, but I think it's very pronounced here. But we face record levels of high economic inequality. And it is creating the conditions that are leading to, I think, this wave of struggle that's even taking place here. Even though I think when we look at Chile, when we look at Lebanon, when we look at Iraq, we are looking at what I think will be our future in terms of, and hopefully will be our future. It has to be our future. If it isn't our future, there is no future. Because unless the U.S. working class joins in that, then it makes it much less likely that there's going to be a global change that needs to take place, a global revolution.
Well, you mentioned Lebanon, and I wanted just to give some context, just a little bit of Lebanon, because it's around 1.3 million people, or 20% of the population, are thought to have attended the largest demonstrations so far last Sunday. In Chile, in the capital of Santiago, there are people that are out on the streets, and the military has gone out on the streets, and Presidente Sebastián Piñera, if I remember correctly, is imposing a curfew and has a military going out there, that the UN has had to send out people to go observe the protests, because it has been said that even if people go out after the curfew, that they are getting shot at. And you can see this if you just go on YouTube, and it doesn't matter what source, you're going to see just footage out there. I mean, the way it's described will be dependent on what source you're seeing, but the footage, I'm just talking the footage, if you go see it, it's there. And that's in Chile, and Iraq, and Hong Kong. I'm not going to discuss Hong Kong, because for me, I'm still trying to figure out. It's challenging, Hong Kong.
I think it's a piece of the puzzle. I think the U.S. is taking advantage of it.
I think so.
But it's a piece of the puzzle of people's anger. And just like, this gets back to where we were talking with Kenny about, when do we think the U.S. is coming in and, you know, taking advantage and controlling it?
When is the U.S.
in the case of Hong Kong, it's clear that the U.S. is going to use every advantage to get themselves in there and inconvenience and embarrass and create problems for China.
And
as
the
much
mainstream
as they can.
Media is going to concentrate on Hong Kong and not Lebanon.
Yeah, or not Chicago,
because
or
it's not
GM.
Benefiting
they're not going to talk about the United States.
Right,
and yes,
right. You're right. Yeah,
but I agree. They're not going to talk about one set. They're not talking about the struggle in Iraq.
They're covering Hong Kong,
rightly. Right, because it's all about China. But anything that inconveniences and makes trouble for the United States, mainstream media is pretty much a much lighter touch.
And it's interesting, though, that the spark of some of these, like in Nicaragua, it was around the pensions.
Yeah.
In Chile, it was about the metro.
Transit
hype.
Fares, yeah.
Uh-huh.
And in Lebanon, was it like WhatsApp?
Right.
It was
tax.
Crazy, yeah.
So WhatsApp. It's these little things that you just now, the capitalist class is realizing, they might just ignite their own fire.
Right, yeah.
If they are trying, even the Yellow Vest movement, it was just an increase on the price of gas, petrol.
Correct.
And Hong Kong, again, that's divisive, right? But it was the extradition bill.
Mm-hmm.
So it just seems to be that these small things can almost light up people.
Yes, yeah.
Like if it was a cigarette butt and you're lighting up a forest.
Right. There's a saying, the straw that breaks the camel's back. Right? Have you heard that saying?
No, I haven't.
Basically, it means you keep putting straw on the camel's back, and you put one more piece of straw in it, like breaks its back, you know? Because it's carrying straw or something like that. So I think that's what we're seeing. We're seeing like people have been taking enough and enough and enough. And like you mentioned, in the growing inequality across the globe.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I just think it's important when we talk about GM and Chicago and the fact that class struggle is on the rise in the United States, we have to see us as we are part of this global world.
The international world.
We're behind. Mm-hmm. We're behind as a working class.
Oh, yeah.
But we're part of it. We have a big responsibility to try to catch up.
Yeah, yeah. And honestly, this gives me some hope.
I agree.
To me, it gives me. I wasn't sure what your response was going to be, so I was just going to state my own. It just gives me some hope.
But if it doesn't get converted to socialist revolution, then this turns to the other way. Then all this stuff will become bitterness, becomes ashes in the mouth, and becomes people fighting against each other. So unless these struggles get directed into the way of mass international working class revolution, then all this hope will turn into bitter, bitter, like, badness, you know. And it is what Kenny said last week. You either get fascism, you get socialism or barbarism.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the choice offered. There is no other choice.
Yeah. And this is on top of other protests, like the climate crisis protests, right? And on environmentalism. Again, for our listeners, whether you believe and what is the cause and root cause of this climate crisis, I'm not going to debate that right now with Andy.
I think the big question...
But again, it's an attack and assault on the environment, destroying lots of things such as our forests, our waters are being polluted by all the profit-driven dirty meddling of our natural resources.
My question is not about whether capitalism destroys the environment. My question about those movements is how independent are they of the Democratic Party? They seem... that's the thing.
We should tackle that on another episode.
But that is important, though. That is a critical piece of it, because you cannot... And what
it's
I
almost
am
like what you're saying about Hong Kong, when people say that is driven by some other...
But what I'm most... The most inspiring thing for me of Chicago and GM workers is Oakland, actually. Is when I see Oakland teachers willing to fight and throw their fists at police, which they wouldn't have done before, then I know something's happening within our class. And I guarantee you, they did not get that message to do that from the Democratic Party. And that's the important. It's not about fist fighting with the police. It's about the independence. And that's the element to me and it's about the lesson. It's about saying, this is not my state. You police who defend the Democrats and Republicans are not part of defending me. And when the working class starts to do that and say, I'm not waiting for marching orders from the Democratic Party, I'm not waiting for Ocasio-Cortez to tell me what I should do to get rid of Russian bots, you know, and say that Russia's the problem, you know, we're going to fight this on our own, then we're getting somewhere. And that's the feature of it that I think is most important. That is my criticism of the environmental movement, is it was too much in the hands
of the Democrats.
Of the Democrats, and too much being used as a tool around electioneering.
All right. Well, this will be another episode. Yep. Otherwise, we'll be here for 2 hours.
Yeah, that's great.
And what I did want to point out, one protest in particular, and this one is because I'm getting WhatsApp messages from my friend I told you, from Carlos, in Barcelona, is on the independence movement, or the lack of, because of the hindrance of in Catalonia, which is not just Barcelona, but there's a section near Barcelona where on the very northern eastern part of Spain is trying to independentize themselves. And maybe we'll do it another time when I'm in Spain, because I'm going this year, and we will give greater context. But it's different from the other ones, where it's about really people wanting to independentize themselves from an empire. They really don't want to be part of this long-lasting empire anymore. Mm-hmm. And when there was a referendum 2 years ago, and this is very brief, I'm just going to go very brief on this, there's a backlash against the people who have tried to put a referendum for independentization. Mm-hmm. And this is the same thing that I remember in England in Scotland as well, when Scotland was trying to independentize themselves. But if you belong to an empire, like a great empire like Spain or England, the USA for Puerto Rico, you're just not going to get out of their hands. They're just going to hold you very tightly. You belong to them. Mm-hmm. You are their property, and you have value, and you're going to you're not going to be let go. So I thought maybe we should another time go into it, but I think that one was a bit different from all these other protests, because it isn't, well, in there, of course, it could intersect some about disparities and inequality and all of that, right?
Yeah.
But it's the banner in front of it is the independence
movement.
Right.
Yeah.
And on Friday in Barcelona, the 18th of October, there were 525,000 people gathered there. And this is all instigated from having had 9 Catalan separatist leaders guilty of sedition and misuse of public funds over their roles in a failed push for independence 2 years ago. And they were sentenced to between 9 to 13 years in prison. So, again, another time we'll do this as far as that one, but I thought that one was one distinct one from different ones, right?
Okay.
I just want to bring it up because Andy, this is not your show.
I know, I'm just saying. I'm just like, okay, go ahead.
I'm trying to. Carlos, estoy también intentando darte un poco de espacio aquí durante este programa. ¿Eh? Vale. So, anyhow, I'm just giving shout out to him.
Yes.
He won't listen to this. He said it's all in English.
Oh, he might have heard that last part then.
All right. I think that is, for me, mentioning all of these things are really hope, as I was saying. I didn't realize it was going to give you hope. I'm actually surprised for you. Mm-hmm. You're usually very cynical about all of these things. But really, I'm glad you told me in a text message this morning. interrupting my meditation time because you sent it exactly at 6 a.m.
Yeah.
I was just going to get done with it. But where I'm glad you said that we would discuss it in the greater context of the global protests that are happening. So it also gives me hope that, remember we had asked, I had asked you in an interview question that I asked you on one of the episodes that I had said to you, how will we be able to have a revolution if technology is there to hinder? And now we're in an era of technology, and it has been used by protesters.
Yeah, it had a double-edged sword.
Yeah. So I think that that gives me some preview on the future.
And do you see why I also say this bears on the thing we discussed with Kenny last week about why I said, Kenny said the revolution is going to have to start in the United States or else it's not going to, you know, it won't happen. And I do believe that it will have to happen eventually in the United States or else it will get crushed. But I don't think I would set a precondition for thinking it has to start here. Because I do think it's very possible for explosions of militancy and even that militancy potentially, if it's organized well enough, could lead to a socialist revolution in some other country that could then lead to the possibility of another country and then another country and then an advanced industrial country. And I do think that's a possibility. Mm-hmm. So,
and I think that one area that I struggle with is when you talk about momentum, that it has to happen across like a wave immediately. If it was to happen here, then other capitalists would try to come in. And so you had said that it has to happen like a domino effect everywhere.
Right? Yeah, I mean, it can't be this long, protracted process.
Right.
I don't think
so. I don't agree with the reformist view, but I'm still, inside me, I'm still...
Gestating.
Yeah, I'm wondering.
Rolling around in your mouth. Mm-hmm. Yeah, makes sense.
Anyhow. Anything else?
No, I'm glad we did this episode. It was kind of all over the place, you know? I mean, but, you know, if people are listening, I think this stuff is interesting.
You're the one saying it's all over the place.
Yeah, you know, but I think it needed to be. And I think next week we might have our interview with Will, which we've done. But also I've reached out to Donna, who was in Oakland, you know? Oh. So we might need to go to that, but we'll see. I think, I'm not sure there's a time sensitivity on the stuff around the Oakland teachers. But there's a lot of lessons here, and I do think it's a hopeful one. Even in the defeats, people learn lessons, and it's going to be these defeats that are going to teach people lessons.
Yeah. Anyway. All right. This concludes our show. Please check us out on any of our five platforms on BitChute, Stitcher, Google Play, iTunes Podcast, or YouTube. Subscribe, rate, review, and best of all, share with your family and community. Thank you, and we'll catch you all later.
See you next week.
Ciao. So first few words.
Welcome to What's Left.
Andy, come on.
I think we intended on just talking about the Chicago strike, Chicago teacher strike, but...
On today's show, the topic of today's show will be on...
Strikes in the United
strikes
States?
Strikes and global protests.
Yes.
All right, there we go. All right, let's go.
But there are also strikes happening in these countries, Chile. It's not just protests.
Well, they're not United Syndicate protests, right? They are... just mostly middle class people. And they're not like organized, like the union is here organizing
the
this
unions
strike.
Are participating in some of those things. I mean, some of them are general strikes that have happened, and I think like in Chile, right?
Yes.
So,
but they're but
and
they
Lebanon.
Were, yes, in Lebanon and Iraq.
So
well, why don't?
Okay, I mean, yeah. Let's see what we make of that.
Against why austerity we? Measures.
Yeah. Everything's right. And strikes and. Okay, fine. Fuck it up as much as you want.
Behind the scenes with Andy Lips. All right. Well, did you want to have an online discussion about some other things about me?
No.
That I need to improve on in my life?
No.
I have. Okay. I need to be more cheerleading.
Look, your perfectionism for yourself leads to you not necessarily recognizing the things that people around you, the people who you're most close to, that what they do. So it's related to your own perfectionism. So you can't really be blamed for it.
Jesus.
The degree to which you whip yourself, you then have to whip those people most close to you.
This is true.
Yeah. It's just the way it is. Brandy suffers from the same thing.
So. Oh, wow.
You and Brandy are like the same person.
You should save this clip for Brandy. Because I just didn't realize. It's like, oh my gosh, more on that list. All right, Brandy, we have to focus right now. All right.